from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan. Today, I have a very special guest on for what I call the Atheist Appreciation Month. And I guess I'm probably the only one who's going to do this, and I guess I'm technically a couple days early into that month. But hey, screw technicalities. I just like things getting done. And I felt, the reason I felt this is because I guess through my internet travels, I have seen people who are doing good work, but not necessarily getting the recognition or the proper understanding, if you will, of what they're doing, because like any fledgling or group or organization, there are very few historians about it. Most people are sort of like generally confused while this crazy thing is happening, and we only have like, you know, the benefit of hindsight when it's already been done and it's over. So with that in mind, today I have a very special guest. And this person was referred to me by the Friendly Atheist. I was on Twitter. I asked him, hey, who do you think I should interview for an Atheist Appreciation Month? Who isn't getting the recognition? And he told me that Liz Liddell, who works for the Student Secular Alliance, is doing an awesome job, but not getting the corresponding amount of love. So I have her on the line, and she's going to be able to answer a whole bunch of questions that I have about what she does, about what her background is, and so on and so forth. Thank you for joining me, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me, Jacob.
No, it's definitely my pleasure. I've been following what you guys have been doing for a little while, and referring young people who sometimes write to me and they say, like, I want to get involved or I want to start a group. Who should I talk to? And right away I'm like, okay, Student Secular Alliance, I know they do stuff. But, you know, I am a lazy man in many respects, so there's a lot of what you guys do that I don't know, or at least I didn't know until I started doing a little bit of research. And I want you to tell me about all the wonderful things that your organization does, why it's around and why it's necessary, and how I got started.
Sure. Well, we got started around the year 2000 because we recognized that there was a need in the freethought movement at the time for an organization that was specifically dedicated to serving secular students and secular student groups on college campuses. At the time, there was not a lot of grassroots support, and there was even less grassroots support for students, and so there was a really big need, and a group of extremely passionate and dedicated volunteers, students leading groups back in 2000, got together and said, this is what we need, and they started the Secular Student Alliance at that time. We've grown an awful lot since then. We started hiring staff in 2003, and today we're actually hiring for our 15th staff member here in our brand new office space in Columbus, Ohio. So it's been a long journey over the last 12 years, but we've been very successful.
I remember I was reading an article, I think it was actually an infographic, comparing the SSA to, I guess, what would be the Christian analog. I'm trying to remember the name of this, the Christian something foundation.
They're calling themselves CRU now. It's CRU? What used to be Campus Crusade for Christ. And we do sort of refer to them as our cultural competition because we're both worldview-based organizations. We both organize on college campuses and we sort of have a vaguely similar model. But yes, we've been very successful lately. If you count the current number of Secular Student Alliance affiliates, we have about 353 groups, which is an incredible number of affiliates. Campus Crusade for Christ, which has been around for a couple of decades now, has about 1,100 campuses where they serve students. So we are, about a third of the way to catching up with them, and we've only been doing this for 12 years.
And the funding difference.
I mean, the funding difference is great. CRU operates on about $500 million a year budget. And this year, our annual operating budget is $998,000. So we have about one 500th of their budget.
Oh, my goodness. Peanuts. We're talking peanuts here. And even your analysis was also that the amount of groups is declining despite this massive amount of funding that they're getting.
I actually need to clarify that. In my original post, which you saw, I did report that CRU's numbers were dropping, and I had taken that from a facts and statistics website on the Campus Crusade for Christ website, It turns out we posted that article, and a religion news service reporter called Crew and said, "Hey, what's up with you losing all these groups?" And they said, that's totally a mistake." And they updated the page very suddenly, now that people were actually looking at it. And so, as it turns out, Crew is still growing. They've added approximately 60 groups in the last 2 years.
Okay, so what you're saying is you lit a bit of a fire under their ass.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Oh, well, you know what? That's kind of one of the things that I've said throughout this podcast, is the fact that as great and liberating as it is to declare ourselves as atheists, it's going to create a counter-reaction that we cannot underestimate. You know, it sort of pushes the individuals that are on the maybe pile, probably hopefully towards our end of the spectrum, just if, you know, because you're saying these are conflicting worldviews, and the other side is going to be like, what the fuck, and they have a gigantic pile of money that they're sitting on.
Yeah, they do. And they are throwing it at campuses, and really, you know, even though they are still growing, they are not growing very fast, and they are not having the impact that we are having with a fraction of their budget.
Well, I think it's just because, as I think the same article outlined, proportionate to the population, young people are becoming less religious, and that's just a fact.
It is. That's correct.
And I could imagine that in the light of all that growth, probably what's happening is that even, from one level to another in a school, you might even notice that it's younger people that are looking at the older groups to say, like, we need some form of secular alternative to this religious shit that's all around me.
That's exactly right. When we have students contact us who are interested in starting groups on their campus, we send out about 500 packets to interested students every year, and these students very, very frequently say, yes, I looked at my campus website, and there were 22 religious groups and nothing for secular students. And so that need is there, and students are recognizing that need, and they're coming to us because we're the only ones providing an outlet and resources to support them in that.
So take me through the process. Let's say I'm in some school that does not have any sort of secular alternative to these religious groups. What is normally the process that someone goes through? Let's say they find your site and they're like, okay, what's the first thing that I should do?
The first thing I'm going to have you do is request a group starting packet. These are free packets of information and materials that we send out to any student, faculty member, off-campus supporter who's interested in getting a group started. We don't charge for them, although you can make a donation if you're really excited about it. But we're going to provide you with a group running guide, which is a handbook on getting a group started and running it once it's up and running. We're going to send you a stack of flyers that are customized to your school and to your campus. We will send you tacks with which you can hang up those flyers. And then we send you a lot of materials on the specifics of getting a group started, as well as some materials that we're able to send your group more of, sort of as some samples to say, hey, look at, you know, you can get some of these or some of these or some of these if they're helpful for you.
Now, is there a part of all of that documentation that allows the organization, to kind of benefit from some good advice in terms of, you know, maybe finding some funding? Because, I mean, as I imagine, a lot of these religious groups, they have deep pockets while we don't. And we kind of have to look at that realistically. I mean, remember all those organizations used to have those fucking chocolate bars? I mean, do we have some kind of alternative to the chocolate bar?
We're working on it. The first step that we actually do need groups to go through is to get recognized by their campus, because there's a couple different ways that funding can come in, and the Secular Student Alliance can certainly provide some funding, but as I mentioned, our budget is not that big, and we can't provide every group with all of the funding they could possibly need. And so by gaining recognition on campuses, a student group actually opens themselves up to a lot of different funding streams, like cooperating with other recognized groups, working with departments on campus, like, say, the biology department or the geology department. And they also usually gain access to a student activities fund. This is sort of a big pot of money that every student pays into every semester. It's usually like a $15 student activities fee that gets slapped on top of their tuition bill. And that pools together and creates this massive pot of money that most student organizations have access to. And they either can apply through an annual budget or on an event-by-event basis to have access to that funding to hold events for the campus. And this is how, Campus Crusade for Christ hold these porn and popcorn events, where they provide free popcorn to all the students and then bring in some washed-up porn actress to say how Jesus saved her life. And
that sounds like a fun event.
Oh, it's a fantastic event. I like to pick on it, but although there's a lot of misinformation in it, and it's masquerading as an official campus event, so they're kind of dangerous in a lot of ways. To say nothing of really insulting, because they come and say that, well, when I was an atheist, I was a terrible person, and you can't be good without God, and a lot of bullshit. And our students call them on it, but by being recognized, students can access that funding too, and so they can tap in and bring bigger name speakers like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Sam Harris to sort of have a counter influence, to bring a rational perspective to the campus.
And I have to imagine that, especially with the way that the scene is, some of these quote unquote big names might be a lot more accessible, especially when you realize that there's an activist level to it. This is not, lots of, great speakers would probably be willing to do it for, a lot less than people imagine, just because they probably recognize the importance of doing so. Am I right?
You are right. There are a lot of fantastic speakers like P.Z. Myers and Michael Shermer, and actually Richard Dawkins himself, who work very willingly with student groups and give discounts on their normal speaking rates because they're passionate about getting out there and reaching young minds. I can't speak for everyone. There are some speakers who just have such high demands on their time and expertise that they aren't able to give us that kind of discount. But for the ones that have, we've put together a speakers bureau that our affiliated groups can access. They can get these discounted rates. And then if they need it, they can get a little bit of funding to help make it happen.
So if a person really wants to say create an organization at their high school, and they the way that they should proceed, what's kind of like the initial goals to try to, because we already mentioned the fact that somebody getting in touch with you benefits at least financially from getting advice of monies that are already available out there. This part we can say they can do. And second, they can obviously bring in people, which would only attract more members, which would only sort of like help in terms of the cause of them growing. But
right.
But beyond the whole growth of a group, which is probably the first thing that an individual is going to be interested in, beyond that, what are the kinds of activities and missions that these groups typically get involved in? What is it that you what are some of the advice that you'd give and say, like, this is the kind of your first steps that you should take?
Sure. Well, some of the first steps we should take are the boring ones, honestly. You need to write a constitution. You need to get recognized by your school. Often at high schools, since you mentioned it, that involves a very messy fight with the administration, in which the administration says, I don't like atheists, so you can't have your group. And we write them a very firm letter that says, that's illegal. You need to allow them to have your group. And, oh, here's our copied lawyer on this email. So really, you should step into line. And usually about that time, the administrator realizes they don't want a lawsuit and they back down. But, a lot of that, the very first couple of weeks of a group are that sort of logistics thing. But beyond that, once we get to the point where we've got a stable group that's actually having meetings, our groups tend to focus in four different areas. Education is a really big one. Things like discussion meetings, bringing in those speakers, and also holding events like tabling, so you can get the name of your group out and pass out literature about non-theistic worldviews on a campus or in a high school, so that other students, start to correct some of the misconceptions and stereotypes that are out there. Another area is service. Community service and service projects, charity work are a big area that our groups like to focus in. Activism is our third area. So we have groups that will go protest laws that are trying to put creationism into schools, or they will go and try to convince a city that a prayer at the beginning of the city council meeting is illegal and they should change it to a moment of silence, so on and so forth. And then the last one, and this is actually in most cases the most important, is community. The vast majority of our groups are primarily a safe space for atheist students to come together, to be able to relax, to not have to worry about what they say because the person next to them is going to get offended, and to just kick back and hang out with people who are like them.
Would you say that that's probably one of the elements that people underestimate is really important?
I think it is. I think we sort of have this, if you've never walked around in an atheist t-shirt and you're a religious person, you have no idea what it's like to live your life as an atheist. But everybody who is knows that you know, when you go to get your hair cut and someone asks you where you go to church, that that's a giant conversation stopper and you're going to walk out with a terrible haircut, or that you can't really say what you think about separation of church and state in the classroom because the student next to you is wearing a cross around her neck, and that that, you know, you kind of walk with this constant self-censorship because because of so much Christian privilege that's in our society as a whole.
Well, I mean, I talk a lot of, on the show of getting people to be out about their atheism. Of course, only if this is not, you know, this doesn't involve incarceration or physical harm to them, obviously. There's going to be some limits. But to those individuals that I'm like, you have the ability to do so, and your hesitation is because you fear being rejected by people around you, I got to tell you that it is a lot worse to live a lie than to live a lonely truth.
Yeah, well, and I'm not going to lie, it can suck either way. But coming out is the single most important thing we can do as individuals to make a difference in how our society perceives non-theistic people. The evidence has shown over and over and over again that the most influential factor in a person's view on LGBT rights is whether they know that they know an LGBT person. Not whether they know a person, because we all know LGBT people, but whether they know that they know it. And the exact same thing is true for atheists. It's not that everybody knows atheists, they just don't realize it. It's whether they know an atheist, and that's what changes people's minds. And so by coming out, we're able to make that statement and say, look, I'm your neighbor, you know I'm a good person, are you going to throw everything we've got away just because now you know what I believe about the world? And the more of us who come out, the more people are going to realize they're just our neighbors, it's okay.
Well, you know, that is why I rather egotistically call myself the Harvey Milk of fucking atheism, because to some degree, when I look at the way that the man employed that his strategy, the closeness that we share with the LGBT movement in general. I mean, like the fight for them to have their own groups or alliances is parallels to ours, and in sometimes ours is even harder.
It can be, and even though we've had, the LGBT movement has done a great job of trailblazing for us, because in a lot of cases we can point and say, look, you didn't like that group either, and you let them form. Well, how is our group any different? And we can sort of ride on their coattails, but even so, we have, you know, groups at high schools with LGBT groups on the high school campus whose administrators turn around and say, no, I don't like your group, you can't have it.
It is fairly shocking, although, like you said before, I mean, I feel like there is a certain amount of trailblazing. And maybe this is why the atheist scene feels such closeness with the civil rights movement is what I'll call it now, because this should really be what it should be called. It's like, it's time to take that word now, because the people who held the torch of civil rights no longer fucking light it for the civil rights of others. Be like, well, we just took it from you now. It's
ours.
It's ours.
Hey, thanks. Bye.
Yeah. Goodbye. Exactly. And that's sort of like how I see this whole thing now. The issue is itself the civil rights, but to some degree as well. I mean, we should help carry the torch, and I think we should all be fairly proud as a movement and a group. We have done that unfailingly. I can't imagine a place where that hasn't been done.
We have done a really good job as a movement of reaching out to other groups, largely because I think throughout history, a lot of the oppression of other groups, and especially the LGBT movement, has been religiously driven. And so we come from a worldview that doesn't support things like discrimination against gay people or discrimination against black people or discrimination against poor people. And so we tend to be a lot more opening and a lot more willing to fight for those rights because it's so blindingly obvious to us that they deserve those rights every bit as much as we do.
Well, it is the kind of basic underlying principle that everyone has agreed to, but no one really wants to see implemented, it seems. They seem fearful of it at times, don't they? It's like, I don't want to give equal rights to everybody else. They might do things that I don't like.
I guess I've got to say that hasn't been my experience with the atheist movement. I think we've been pretty willing to get each other's backs in terms of other movements. I'm not going to say it's always been reciprocated. I know for sure that it is easier to be a gay student in one of the SSA's organization clubs than to be an atheist in an LGBT club. It's just it's not always reciprocated. But I think we've in general done a pretty good job of being open with it.
Well, I think that's the underlying thing about the movement itself is in an unspoken sense, the fact that we can't all agree on everything or even most things at all. Yeah, at all. It's just that, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but the enemy of me is unreason, and there's so right. much of it to go around that I don't feel like, you know, that whole problem that some people have is like, well, there'll come a time where, you know, you'll have to say, well, there's a lot that we don't agree on because we're now the majority. I'm like, I don't think we have to really worry about that time, you know, anytime fucking soon. Anytime soon. I'm not too worried about it. I'm like, maybe my great-great-grandchildren can worry about it, and I can write a couple of ideas about how to deal with that world.
Yeah, but let's deal with the one we've gotten right now.
Exactly. I mean, here's what I like. In terms of what you've written in the past, is I like your pragmatism. Because, you know, I'm often forced to one end of the spectrum. Just the nature of what I do is I'm not myself a pragmatist. I don't encourage it in what I say. But I would like to encourage other people who feel that that's the necessary step to do so. Like, I feel like everybody should find the right place, the right balance.
Right, and it takes a pretty big spectrum of people. Quite frankly, I'm not an idealist. I'm very deeply rooted in pragmatism and dealing with what's in front of us right now. That's really my skill set. But if I don't have the vision from people like yourself to work with, then I'm just, you know, randomly doing stuff in a cornfield by myself, and I don't have any direction that I'm really going.
Well, and one of the things that you'd mentioned before in one of your articles, and I think that this part we should probably skip to, because ultimately, even in the first task that we were mentioning, like the very first elements of establishing a charter and just trying to get recognized, the second part of it, and I thought this was an interesting element of your article, you were mentioning whether or not secular groups should work with interfaith organizations.
I catch a lot of crap for that.
And well, that's what I'd like to talk about, because number one, I don't disagree with what you said, but I want to talk first of all, why do you get so much crap for that?
I get a lot of crap for a lot of different reasons, and a lot of them I think are a little bit silly, honestly. One of the big complaints I get is that the name of the movement that we're trying to work with is interfaith, and well, if it's called interfaith, then how can there possibly be a place for non-theists in it, because we don't have faith? Well, okay, if you ever talk to anybody who works in an interfaith movement, if you talk to Eboo Patel, the president of the Interfaith Youth Corps, they recognize that that's not an ideal word for what they're trying to do.
Well, they don't even like the word, right?
They don't like the word, but it happens to be the word that's been picked up. It's like the same way that atheist has been picked up as the word for our movement right now. I'm not going to comment on whether it's good or bad. I think it's fine. But, you know, consider if the label bright or the label naturalist had been picked up for our movement, that's what we'd be working with simply because it's the one that had the media recognition. And that's exactly where the interfaith movement is right now. Interfaith happens to be the word that's being used, even though everybody agrees that it's not the best possible word.
Well, you just don't get to choose the word that defines you. I feel like we just have to kind of get over that fact. I have had countless discussion with non-believers who are like, I don't like the label. Well, too fucking bad. Do you want to live in a world of just this incredible lack of subtlety? Like, you don't have much of a choice. It's being forced on you, ultimately.
Right. It does get forced onto a lot of people, but I think at the same time, it's very valuable to allow people the space to define themselves in the way that they're most comfortable with. You know, if I told you that I was bisexual, you wouldn't have any business coming back and telling me, oh, well, you're just a lesbian and you're calling yourself a bisexual because you're not comfortable with it. Like, whatever. I don't care if I've never slept with a guy in my life. If I still feel that I'm bisexual, then that's my right to defend myself. Likewise, if I feel that naturalist is the best possible word to describe my worldview, you know, I should be able to describe myself that way. Sure, the media is going to call me whatever they want, But you know, I should be able to label myself and refer to myself in the way that I'm the most comfortable. For what's worth, I'm not actually lesbian, and I'm happily married to a dude, lest anybody get any crazy ideas.
Okay, well, all I was going to say about that, though, is that to handle what I would say is, unfortunately, our own kind of cognitive dissonance here. Because we can talk about these labels and how we want to define ourselves all fucking day long. But at the end of the day, being pragmatic about it, we have to you know, admit that there are only so many strategies to be able to employ. I don't care what the fuck the label is. A person who sort of like describes himself as bisexual is not limited to only bisexual issues. They're pushed to the extremes of their positions about sexuality just because of the nature of the movement surrounding them.
Exactly.
And this is where I think that with that in mind, like when we're talking about working with interfaith organizations, why is that all right?
I think very strongly that it's all right because of a number of reasons. Primarily because interfaith is happening. It is a huge trend. The White House and the president are launching the second year of the Interfaith and Community Challenge for colleges all across the country. It's been tremendously successful. It is the trend that's happening right now. And it is the trend that is attempting to reach out to students of different worldviews and bring them together. And we have two options. We can get in and we can say, we have a place at this table, give us our damn chair, and we're going to be involved in this. Or we can say, oh, we don't like this for some reason, we don't feel like we belong, we think it should be different or whatever, and stand on the outside and look in. And if we stand on the outside and look in, then we have cut ourselves out of this thing that is happening, and we are telling ourselves, no, you guys go ahead and make a bunch of decisions, we're going to go stand on the sidelines and be marginalized because that's where we'd rather be. I'm done being marginalized. I've been marginalized my entire life. I'm ready to get out there and be involved and take my seat at the table. And that's why I'm involved in interfaith.
I would say that I guess maybe another way to put it is the fact that, you know, like this, the same way that I think that our movement benefits from a kind of deep metaphysical understanding of our own label issues. It
sure.
Doesn't benefit from it in terms of its marketing. And
yeah.
When we look at the numbers, I mean, you know, think about how Constantine felt, whether or not this story is true or not, where he has a dream of a cross and says, under this symbol, conquer. I mean, you need a symbol, right? And for a movement that prides itself on the lack of symbols, there is a bit of a kind of inherent contradiction there. But I feel like when we fear the accusations, your religion, I think that part is actually our lack of confidence in ourselves, of saying, well, you know what, that doesn't faze me, because number one, if you accuse me of being just as bad as you, what does that say about you, dickhead? Like, but that fear is still there, where like, if I have that, the assurance that I am not a religion because I don't obey the same rules, then it means that you can't play the same game.
Right, and I think part of that, we do get that a lot, working in interfaith. A lot of people say, well, okay, you're just another religion. And part of it comes down to, I think, honestly, just how you define religion. And most interfaith programs define religion as a worldview. How do you see the world? And they're not referring to which deity do you believe in, or which, you know, which holy book do you follow, but what worldview do you identify with? And as for the rest of it, I think it's a fantastic opportunity that when someone says, oh, well, you're just a religion too, you can say, well, not really. You know, we're a worldview, and here's what our worldview is based around, and here are some really important things that we have differences between us. Let's talk about it. I mean, what a great opportunity to sit down and have these conversations, not, you know, with our own group of people who already agree with us, and not with the campus preacher who's never going to change his mind, but with the group of people who are already all there to learn about one another and learn how to coexist.
Well, it's really a good opportunity, I think, for us to just demonstrate our confidence in what we're saying by not needing to worry about at the end of the day, these labels that we're just constantly obsessed over, even though we're like, well, there is no label. Yeah, but you're obsessing about it.
You're right. You're obsessing about the fact that there isn't a label.
It's like at the end of the day, nothing's happening. Nothing. And this ultimately, I guess, is where I find that the benefit of any program, be it that you know, there may be people that work within your organization that don't necessarily agree with everything you're doing. Is it
That's
true
correct.
Or false? Right. But they have to kind of accept the fact that there is only so much that you can do, a limited amount of paths that you can choose in order to be able to have an effective strategy.
Sure. And well, one of the things the SSA does that I think has been one of our strengths is that we are a big tent. We work very hard to not tell our groups what to do, but let them decide what they're going to do and then support them while they do it. And that gives us the flexibility to allow and support the groups that want to engage in interfaith without, you know, making any requirements of the groups that say that's bullshit and I don't want anything to do with it. They don't have to. But that doesn't mean we're going to stop supporting the groups that do. And then we'll turn around and we'll support Atheist Agenda in their Smut for Smut programs. And every group basically gets the support in doing what's best for their group.
Now, here's I guess, the second part of what I wanted to talk about. Because now if you were a young person, you were in a school that doesn't have this and you want to get involved and you still have questions about what to do, then I want to slap you in the face because you don't understand how the internet works. I think we've just laid out the groundwork. Get it fucking together, people. But the second part now is if you're already a convinced young person, which I hope you are, if you're not and you're a little bit older and you're not in school, tell this person what they should do now in order to actually help facilitate that. Because there's obviously room for people that are above the high school age.
Absolutely. The biggest thing that you can do to help facilitate what we're doing is become a member of the Secular Student Alliance. We are a membership organization, and membership is not only for students. The vast majority of our funding comes from non-student supporters. And actually, at the moment, we have a matching offer at the table, an incredibly generous $250,000 match from Jeff Hawkins and Janet Strauss. Jeff Hawkins happened to be the inventor of the Palm Pilot. They love what we're doing. They understand how important it is, and they've asked you to help us support it. So if you've been thinking about getting involved, or if you've been thinking about an organization to join, the Secular Student Alliance would love to have you, and there's not a better time than right now.
And for them, like, it's divided into lots of different kinds of ways that you can do this, right? It's not just financial. It's like volunteering for time, because it seems as though the majority of work that's still being done is volunteer only.
There is a lot of volunteer work being done, although I'd have to say I'm going to give a shout out here. The best volunteers we have are those students who are leading our affiliate groups. They are amazing, brilliant, creative, passionate students, and we wouldn't be anywhere without them. But beyond that, we do have some volunteer positions. Some of them are here in our office in Columbus, Ohio, and there are a couple of ways that people can get involved. Beyond that, we have some need for occasionally some people to help us write things. We have some need to help with hands-on support for local groups. So if you have a group in your backyard or at the school you went to, you know, reach out to that campus group and see if they need a help. Things that are peanuts to us as grown-ups are huge to students on campus. It could cost you, you know, $30 to get 6 pizzas from Little Caesars and take it to your student group, and that makes a world of difference for that group meeting to be able to say, we're going to have pizza tonight, make sure everybody comes out. And it's just, you know, it's something that we don't even notice out of our pocketbooks anymore.
It's child economies are different.
That's exactly right. Students do not have a lot of money, but a couple of pizzas will go a long way.
That, I think, is probably one of the important things that people need to recognize. With any group, there are periphery ways to be involved. And with that in mind, now I want to know more about you in terms of your work with this, because I feel like, okay, we've covered the organization fairly well, and beyond that, everyone's going to start to yawn on me and say, like, all right, I get it. You've drilled it down, Jacob. I need to somehow get involved in whatever way possible. And, and P.S., thank you so much for getting me involved. Now accepting letters, by the way, thanking me. But finally, I want to know, like, how did you get involved? Like, what's your background? I think I read somewhere that you had you did come from a religious or somewhat semi-religious background. You did do your due diligence, and then you just decided it was no good?
It was not for me. It was not for me. I actually started out for the first 10 years or so of my life being raised in a secular household, and then somewhere around there, my family decided that maybe it would be good for us to start going to a church.
Oh my God, they doubled down.
Yeah, they did. They said, oh, we gotta go to church. So we went to this Episcopal church, and it was very pleasant. And I remember thinking a couple of times between Bible school and confirmation classes, thinking, you know, this is people take this really seriously for kind of, you know, a mythological view of the world. Do people really believe this stuff? And so I went along with the motions. I was baptized. I was confirmed. But I never saw it as more than a set of mythology, as a way that a pre-technological culture had described things that they couldn't understand. And when I started to realize that people actually believed this, and particularly in the Episcopal Church, which has very clearly documented the history of the church in that the English king wanted to divorce his umpteenth wife, and the Pope said no, and he said, well, screw you, Pope, I'm going to go start my own church. And somehow people think this is the right church? Really? Just I couldn't get over it. And so, you know, when I went to college and I wasn't living with my parents anymore, I said, you know what, this is not for me. And I'm just going to go back to living the world the way it really is instead of trying to force this extra layer onto it.
So I'm trying to get an image in my mind of you as a child. And all I get, at least my initial impression, is someone who probably questioned everything to death. Is this true?
In between throwing temper tantrums, yes.
Okay, I see.
I was a very angry child.
Well, you sound like a fucking handful right there. Do you constantly, you know, I hope that you sent back a lot of love here, because it sounds like someone needs an infinite amount of patience.
My parents have been very patient with me, and they know that I appreciate it a very great deal. I couldn't ask for better parents.
Well, I suppose both you and I are lucky in those regards, because I was very similar as a kid, because, you know, when you described to me your deconversion, like, there was never a conversion there to begin with. Yeah, that sounds familiar, where you got to a stage where by the time the stories came to you and you weren't told these were literal facts, you're just like, this is dumb.
Yep. I was taught to be a very polite kid, so I said, these are very interesting stories.
Well, this is the big difference. I was not taught to be polite. Or if I was, I rejected this lesson. Now, so you have this secular background. They dabble in religion. You reject. Now, you went to school, and you have a master's in something unusual. You have a master's in a bassoon. Is this right?
That's correct. I have a master's of music, specializing in bassoon performance. I'm classically trained. I could theoretically go get on the audition circuit and start auditioning for professional symphonies all over the country.
And why don't you?
Turns out I'm a morning person, and symphonies perform at night, and that's really incompatible lifestyle.
What an arbitrary reason. You know, I think I should have joined the symphony. I'm a night person. I didn't realize. I thought you needed to wake up early to do music or something.
No, not at all. It's very much the opposite. But obviously there's a lot more that went into it than that. But that's one of the biggest factors. I'm up with the sun every morning, and if you're up till, 10 or 11 performing every night, then that becomes very difficult very quickly.
That's interesting. I'd never realized. But there is some evidence to suggest that people do feel more creative during the nighttime. So maybe there's a strong creative effort there that they've managed to exploit. But you, unfortunately, through...
I've missed out on that one.
you missed out on that one. I missed out in the mornings. You know, I think that's why I'm a bad worker.
I can't judge that.
Well, it sounds to me, at least with everything you've got juggling on the organization, that you probably get a lot of shit done. Are you a get shit done person?
I am a do tank. That's sort of the official word here for what we do.
Well, what does your day involve? Like, what does the director of the SSA do?
I do a lot of things, but at this point, and I'm a little sad to say this, I don't get to work directly with my student leaders as much as I used to, because now I have a team of staff, and that's their job. So my day is a combination of working with the other director-level staff at the Secular Student Alliance to make sure that they know what's going on here in the campus organizing department, to make sure that my team knows what they're supposed to be working on, helping them solve problems and get their work done. At the moment, I'm training two new regional campus organizers. We're piloting a regional program in the Southeast and in Texas, so there's been a lot of training, and we're getting ready to train some new board members this weekend, so it's been very busy. And I have two interns starting on Monday.
Well, I guess the best analogy that I could provide, it, this is my nerd analogy, is you went from being a captain to being an admiral now.
Yeah, that's about right, actually. Yeah. It's a big shift, and it's been really interesting to sort of, you know, now that I can step back and sort of watch how that's changed, it's been fascinating.
But you miss being a captain?
I do. I miss working with my student leaders. You know, they are just some of the best people in the world. And, you know, it's a little disappointing that I don't get to come in and talk to them every day anymore.
Do you get kind of the feeling sometimes that you're just like, wow, these are the brains of the next generation. These fucking people are amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're going to put me to shame in 10 years. Well, they're putting me to shame now. I mean, heck, I'm not going to lie.
I've thought about this a lot. You know, there's a few of my fan base that, you know, they've come and they've got in touch with me. And their degree of comprehension, because on many shows, I'm laying it out pretty strong. I'm trying to come up with creative thoughts, putting it out there, and they're being digested by people. But, you know, it's the same way that we stand on the shoulders of giants. They could just toy around with any idea that you come up with and just one-up you. That's the whole point. That's the point where, you know, all of a sudden you look at the evolution of art or even music, and you probably see this, is that you don't have to be a Mozart to hear Mozart.
Right.
And what influence that has on anyone making art, that they can actually imitate a limitless supply of the greats.
Right. You have a lot of material to work from. And I feel like that here too. One of the things I tend to say is that, you know, our groups are autonomous. Not only because we don't have the capacity to tell them all what to do, we don't have the staff or the energy, but also because they're going to come up with better ideas than we are. They're going to do more creative events and more great ideas and more awesome programs and projects than we are ever going to come up with here in the national office. And if we try to tell them what to do, then we're going to lose all of that.
Well, I think this is one of the main reasons why I think that you know, some of the young listeners should get involved right away, is I don't think they really fully understand their own potential until they finally have people that you know, that they respect being like, you're on the right track, kid.
You're on the right track. I don't care what you're doing. You're probably on the right track. Keep doing it.
But that's not something they're going to hear in most of the places that they are.
No, they're probably not. They're going to get a lot of negative pushback. They're going to get a lot of bullying from other students around them. They may get pushback from their administrators. They might get pushback from their parents or their friends' parents. And I've got to say, just stick with it and keep on showing them that you are a fantastic person, and keep on being a good person and doing the best you can, and it will so be worth it in the long run.
Well, we rely on those people to make our movement legitimate. It's not people like me that really make it legitimate. It's them, because if it was for me, I would be a tyrant. I'm like, no one give me power, please. I should not be given it. I'm an extremist in the greatest of senses. But you know, it is the people who just absorb all of that, the negativity that I'm not. I'm not influenced by it. They are. They're the ones who are fighting that fucking fight. And I'm the one just sort of like throwing out punches and having people walk right into it. It's unfair, I tells you. So I feel for them. And I think that, you know, be you young, be you old, definitely there's a place for you working with your organization. I think that you guys are probably one of the big ones that I think is – you know, even though you're finally getting some recognition, it could stand to be more.
Absolutely.
just because you made in the numbers themselves, they speak for themselves. When we look at how we should be developing minds, if a greater portion of them are coming out irreligious, we've got them.
Yeah, they are coming. They are so seriously coming our way, and we've got to be ready for them. I was crunching some numbers for that article you mentioned, and if we maintain the same rate of growth right now that we've seen over the last year or two, we will have 1,000 groups in 5 years. And then when you start to look at the context of that there are 6,000 colleges in the United States and 24,000 public high schools, and that the GSA, the Gay Straight Alliance, has over 4,500 chapters, and you look at the impact that the internet has had in spreading name recognition, you look at those 500 packets we're sending out every year, and you start to realize that 1,000 groups in 5 years is a damn conservative estimate, and we're probably going to blow it out of the water.
Well, it's going to happen quicker, you know, sooner than later. I think we're going to find ourselves, you know, because we're only reaching that current wave, and the older generation are the people that are more religious, and they still have all the power.
Yes, they do.
They're not dying because we keep giving them medicine to make them live longer.
They can't live forever.
Dick Cheney gets a fucking heart transplant in his 70s. They're not dying for a reason.
Yeah, they're not, but they're not going to stick around forever. And my work is to train the leaders that are going to take over. I have brilliant young leaders who, when Dick Cheney does die, they're ready to step into his place, and they're going to make some really big changes around here.
Well, this is why I think it's going to catch everyone by surprise, because it's been such a late blooming for, let's say, my generation. It will have an effect on the generation even that's the young generation now, mainly because my generation is basically in a castrated group. We are castrated from power because of this population shift.
Sure.
And this itself has a strong influence, because this group that castrates us is extremely religious. And us as a castrated group are, somewhere in the middle, and the generation that's coming up is not religious at all.
That's correct.
And they're going to, everything's going to bypass us, because I'm probably going to be an old man by the time I finally get some fucking power. And it'll be too late.
Oh, look at Dick Cheney. He's not too old for it.
Well, hopefully by then they're cloning me or something like that. I'm hoping to transfer.
Can I tell you how many times I've wished to have a clone around here?
Well, I imagine with your work list, it's a good thing you're a morning person. See, I could never be a director of anything. I'm a creative that likes to sort of like stay up till all hours of the night, but really gets nothing done.
But you're giving us the vision, and we've got to work together. Otherwise, I'm just drawing circles.
Well, you've got plenty of work to do so far. And like we said before, I think it's going to be definitely a lot more. They're going to probably need to clone you, or at least find the alternative to that. And that may be a person who's listening to this show right now. I want to put
that
out there.
That's very possible. We're growing very, very quickly, and we're hiring new staff all the time. And I'm going to take a moment to give a shout out to my staff team. I have the best staff in the world, hands down. And again, we couldn't do this without them. So if you head over to the SSA website and take a look at the contact page, give a shout out to our staff and tell them thanks, because they are fantastic.
Awesome. Well, you know what? I think that pretty much wraps it up for the show. I think we did our best job to pretty much of propaganda to make sure that people recognize the fact that, even in any organization itself, and this is a very important message to atheists, you may not always agree with the way that things are done, but we must be pragmatic about things. We don't have an unlimited amount of monies, a limited amount of attention, and we just kind of have to realize that it is a luxury to be able to dictate the world will not conform to your fucking idea of how it should be.
You got to go to war with the world we've got.
Exactly. I mean, and like you said before, I mean, we are talking about worldviews. Maybe it's not as well defined as some, and that's fine. I think that actually works well for us. We don't need to define it strongly. We just need to know what we're up against. And I think we have a good idea now. And the people that we're up against, they're pretty fucking scary. So We got our work cut out for us. It's only just fucking begun. But I think the good news is, like you said before, the wave is building. It's just that we have to kind of do our part now to make sure that that's going to have like as much impact as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the good news is that they know we're coming, and they're scared of us. And so we can get out there and we can really make a difference.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. We own the internet, baby.
Yeah, we do.
We own the future of communication, because everyone who's on there will tell you that a large part of their experience of disbelief has been largely thanks to the internet. Just the ability
Absolutely.
To go do research, to have...
And ask those questions and get answers. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been instrumental in our growth over the last decade.
Well, it's been instrumental to mine. I wouldn't actually have a pseudo job if it wasn't for the internet.
Can't imagine why that is.
Well, amazingly enough, I get to do what I do and help promote... worthy causes and worthy people. Liz, I'd like to thank you for being my first guest on my Atheist Appreciation Month. Up next, I'm going to have Peter Boghossian, who's been fighting the world of faith and trying to instill critical thinking. Another person who's on that list of people that you should be aware of. So I want to make sure that individuals are not only connecting with your organization, but also sort of connecting with you. You've got a Twitter as well. I'll have a whole bunch of links in the notes towards that, and follow, like everything they're doing. This is the minimum, people. This is the minimum. All right, with that, my name is Jacob Fortune. Thank you, Liz Liddell, for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, have a great Atheist Day.